That's countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo and Handel's Lascia Chi Pianga from his new album, his debut album, Arc, featuring arias by Handel and Philip Glass. Anthony Roth Costanzo has just been named 2019 Musical America Vocalist of the Year by Musical America. He will be in Boston on November 7th as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston. And he's here to chat with me about his new album and about what it means to be a countertenor. Anthony Roth Costanzo, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to obviously talk to you about this great new album, but first I want to talk about what it means to be a countertenor. What does that really mean to be a countertenor?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I think people are, even when they know the voice type, they're confused. It's a man singing in his falsetto register. And some countertenors would take issue with that because falsetto has the connotation of false. But in fact, it's a head voice. And when women sing opera, they also sing in a head voice. The distinction between chest and head is that your chest is what you speak in and your head voice is this high singing register. So I've just learned basically to sing in my falsetto in a cultivated way, the same way Michael Jackson or Frankie Valli or Justin Timberlake have.
Your new album, your first album, features two composers, Handel and music that is typically associated with countertenors, Baroque opera or arias and so forth, and also Philip Glass. Now, you describe in your program notes, which are fantastic, by the way, that Handel defined you and that Purcell changed you. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling me just a little bit more about what that means and why these two composers.
Definitely. Well, as a countertenor, you know, we're singing a lot of Baroque music that was written for castrated men, which is a hard thing to fathom, but it's true. And so that's the music where that sort of beautiful line and the bel canto technique gets developed. And that's what I grew up doing, Handel. And that's sort of my bread and butter. But as I developed as an artist and as I was finding new pathways, Philip Glass always grabbed me, whether it was in Einstein on the Beach, which I saw at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, or whether it was his soundtrack for The Hours. I found it very moving emotionally. And when I finally got to do the role of Akhenaten and be inside the music, it made me a kind of different performer dramatically, because the psychology he demands with his repetition is actually very human, and it allows you to transcend the sort of daily thought process and move to something which is more profound. And so I was very drawn to that, and I began to see parallels between Handel and Glass. For example, Handel has all of his arias in a da capo form, which means there's an A section, a B section, and then the A section repeats. Right. So there's a kind of built-in repetition there. But even beyond that, he chunks up the text, and instead of putting a sentence in sequence, he'll take a little piece of it and repeat it over and over. So in a way, Handel, I began to see him as the proto-minimalist. He was doing the same things that Philip Glass was doing with music, but with his text and with his form. And he was also finding a similar kind of purity and an emotional sweep in the harmonic changes, which connected to me. And of course, the sound worlds are different and the whole ethos is different, but there were these links between them. And so I thought, well, what if we did them with the same orchestra? And I asked Philip Glass if we could make some arrangements of these pieces I found that really spoke to me. And could we do them with the same band and find this sort of commonality, but also certain spiky differences between them that would be interesting and that wouldn't be the normal countertenor album or the normal anything album, but rather provide a sort of new boundary-pushing viewpoint. And so that's what we've tried to do.
Are there any tracks on the album that sort of highlight that? I mean, I know the whole album is meant to highlight that, but are there any particular tracks that really speak to that Handel and Philip Glass relationship that you have discovered in working in both of those sound worlds?
Absolutely. I think that Liquid Days by Philip Glass, which is really a pop song, it was written on a poem by David Byrne, who wrote that for Philip Glass. And then it was originally done in the 80s by a group called The Roaches, which was a female trio and synthesizers and all that. And we've reimagined it with orchestra, and it still feels like a pop song, but the format is so Handelian. There's an A section, a sort of long B section, and then the A section returns. And there are different tempi, and there's a kind of... a prosody, if you will, a sort of pacing of the emotion, which feels to me as a performer, as someone who's performed a lot of Handel, like what it is to do Baroque music. And there's a purity required for the opening lines of Liquid Days, which comes technically from the exact same way that I sing Handel. So I really feel like I'm not changing what I do to do Philip Glass and a version of a pop song that he wrote, but rather I'm informing it with the tradition and the beauty of Handel. And so for me, it's a real synthesis of the two.
Your Musical America Vocalist of the Year profile hints a little bit about how you became a countertenor, that you started very early on. And I wonder if you might describe that a little bit for us. How did you decide to go in this direction?
I was a young kid taking piano lessons, as kids do, and my piano teacher basically told me I wasn't very good, so should I try singing? And I did, and I loved it, and I was better at that. So I began doing shows in North Carolina, where I grew up, and then eventually, by the time I was 11, I said to my parents, I was quite headstrong, listen, I want to be on Broadway. I want to try it. And so I went to New York, I auditioned, and lo and behold, I was doing Broadway and Broadway national tours and doing all this performing as a boy soprano, as a, you know, kid singer. And by the time I was 13, I had these connections and people said, would you do this opera, The Turn of the Screw by Benjamin Britten? Well, I did it and I discovered the depth of expression and the psychological complexity in something like The Turn of the Screw. And I loved that at 13. And being around all these opera people, they said to me, hey, listen, you know, you've got hair on your arm, your speaking voice is kind of low. I think you've gone through puberty, but you're still singing high. Maybe you're a countertenor. And I'd never heard of a countertenor. I didn't know what that was. But if you're a successful boy soprano, you want to keep singing high as long as you can. So I just started, you know, studying with a teacher and learning how to continue singing high and never looked back. I never thought, well, I should be a tenor or baritone, or I should be more masculine, or there's something, you know, effeminizing about singing high. I never thought about it that way. Of course, it helped to have two parents who were psychologists and who were very forward-thinking. But I then, before I knew it, was just singing high and learning how to sort of stretch my voice over that whole falsetto register. And I've been singing in the treble clef my whole life.
The music that's frequently associated with countertenors is, in particular, is the historically informed Baroque music. But so much of that music, as you mentioned before, is not written with countertenors in mind, but was written for castrati in mind. And I was wondering if there are any challenges in doing music written for that very different instrument than yours. And maybe off of that as well, are there advantages to doing all the new music you're doing, where music is really being written specifically for your instrument?
Yes, it's such a great question. And, you know, the castrati were creatures who were literally sort of neutered at a young age so that they could keep their high voice. And what would happen along with that, which is fascinating to me, I mean, it does give you a primary source connection to the material. What would happen is that because of the hormonal changes that they went through or didn't go through, their bones did not harden as much as our bones do. So they were more cartilaginous. And that meant that their rib cage, for example, could expand an extra 2 inches and they could fit more air into their rib cage. And so Handel goes along and writes these really, really long lines of coloratura or long phrases. And the castrati, where people were tripping over themselves to go hear them hold these long notes in the theater or sing these long phrases. Now, as a countertenor, I've got to deal with that. You know what I mean? Because I don't have the same rib cage capacity. But it's actually a wonderful challenge to learn how to use your breath with economy and do the repertoire the way the castrati did it. So there are all kinds of little things like that that you find that connect you to this grotesque but also fascinating phenomenon of the castrati. But as you were saying, it is exciting to work with composers today and to think that Handel, you know, we can't lump all the castrati together just like we can't lump all sopranos together. They were all different. And Handel was working with each of them. And you can look at his body of work for different castrati and see that he was tailor-making things to their register or their specialty or whatever they did. So for me to work with composers who say, who get together with me and say, I want to hear what makes you happy to sing, and then I want to write you something that exploits that, and I sing that and I do that for many performances, and then it becomes part of a repertoire of our contemporary music that other countertenors will sing, and they'll have to stretch themselves to do what's easy for me but maybe not for them. It's a tradition that just passes on from one generation to the next, and it's really exciting to be a part of it.
I wonder if you could tell me what you might consider to be the most misunderstood aspect of being a countertenor.
I think that people find that, well, one thing is that people always ask me, doesn't it hurt? Don't you get tired much more quickly? And actually, you are singing kind of on the edge of your vocal cords. If you imagine stretching a rubber band as much as you can stretch it and then plucking it, the sound gets higher and higher, right? So we're sort of stretching our vocal cords and singing on the edge of it. So there is some precariousness involved, but once you do it well, it does feel very natural. It doesn't feel like you're straining or that it's particularly hard. I think that's one misconception. And the other thing is the gender question. And I think it's really interesting to talk about in today's world that is it somehow emasculating? Do you feel like you're singing like a girl? And I do in some ways. I'm singing in a girl's register, but it's actually very powerful. The high voice is very penetrating in a theater like the Metropolitan Opera. There's such a brilliance to it that it cuts straight through that acoustic. And so there's a power to singing with a high voice that is different from singing in your chest voice, where if you get really, really loud, it feels like screaming. But somehow as a countertenor, you feel like you're slicing with this fine, pure, clean knife through the air. And so that is empowering in a different way. And I think it confounds people's notion of gender in a way that's novel. I mean, that novelty factor, when I go into a room and people haven't heard a countertenor and they think, what the hell is going on? Why is this guy singing like that? And I love that. I love exploiting that. I love using those 30 seconds of shock to bring people in and to make them really listen to what this music is.
Yeah, that really is interesting. I mean, there has always been a fascination with a male voice singing in that register, both in the 18th century with the castrati doing it, and now, as you're describing, that fascination still exists today when we hear someone like yourself singing. I want to head back to the album for a moment. It has this interesting split. There's the old, the 18th century music, and the new, the 20th century music, 21st century music. And I'm wondering how you see the classical music world evolving, how you as a musician fit into that trajectory, and how you hope your album fits into the trajectory and the future of classical music.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I would venture to say that where it's going and where I want to shape it are two slightly different things, and also two things that can work together. But the album is meant to push the envelope, and I think the future of classical music is in collaboration. When I think about where are the new audiences, I imagine that a crowd that goes to fashion shows or to art openings or to films, they are primed to like beauty. And they may not have a point of access for classical music. It may be intimidating that it's in a different language and they can't understand it. But if you give them a point of access, if I collaborate with a fashion designer, a film director, an artist, all of the people I've been working with, a choreographer for that matter, and I let them see the music through their eyes, they can have a different connection to it. And I think there's something primal, especially about the human voice and opera. It is the first instrument. It is an instrument we all have. And it can connect to your soul. And when you least expect it, at least what I found, working with sixth graders in schools, they don't want to hear opera. They don't like the idea of opera. But when they hear it and when it connects to them, it moves them, and it's in an unexpected way. So it's simply about giving people points of access. But because we live in a world where you're changing between apps and tabs on your browser and all of that, the access has to come in a way and in be delivered in a way that doesn't in any way break down the music or change it, but rather interprets it through another medium, through collaboration, that people are already excited about. So for me, that's the future of classical music. If you look at the cover of the album of Glass Handle, it has a painting by the famous American painter George Condo. So I opted, rather than a glamour shot or some sort of traditional photo of me, I wanted to have an artist's interpretation of this music and of me. And so I think the future for classical music is in interdisciplinary avenues.
Amen. Well, I wish you all the best on breaking those barriers and continuing in the direction you're doing. A big congratulations to you, by the way, for the Vocalist of the Year award. That's a very big honor, I'm sure. And
it is. It's so crazy. Well, thank you so much, and thanks for taking the time to talk.
Anthony Roth Costanzo is the 2019 Musical America Vocalist of the Year. His new album, Arc, is available now. You can also see him in town in Cambridge on Wednesday, November 7, in his Celebrity Series of Boston recital debut at the Longy School of Music of Bard College's Pickman Hall.